Welcome back to Unleash the Goats, where we unleash ourselves upon the Star Wars franchise with reckless abandon, and nobody quite knows what we'll say next, least of all us. I'm Nat, she, her. Angela, say hi.
Hi, I'm Angela / Faye, she, her.
Sugar, say hi.
Hi, I'm Sugar, she, her.
Welcome to this very fun episode that I'm so excited about. Can you guys guess why?
It's Natalie's birthday!
It's my birthday! So I got to decide what we talked about today.
She made all the decisions, all of them.
Yeah. Well, okay. I didn't. Please don't disregard the work that the two of you put into this episode. I don't know if you guys remember, but because someone on Tumblr mentioned to us that they had started from like our intro episode, I was like, oh yeah, we recorded that. I should go back and listen because I don't remember what we said. And one of the things that we said was Sugar and I both mentioned Obi-Wan as like one of our favorite characters. So today we are talking about my dramatic boy, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Fulfilling the prophecy.
Fulfilling the prophecy.
Last month was Faye's baby. This month is our baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've shared the birthday love with Sugar.
They're going back to back because they're brothers.
And because we didn't realize we were doing this, but it worked out really well for us. This was not planned.
We totally did it on purpose. They are literary foils, so they're back to back.
Let the people think that we're smart, Sugar.
Yeah. Fair. Angela, cut this out. It was purposeful. Now I'm like, because you guys can see me, I'm like, holy shit, do I have to be professional?
No.
No. Oh, yeah, for the first time, we're recording with like our video cameras on so we can see each other. You can't see us.
No, it's not for you.
You can't see it. We're never going to post videos of our faces. I'm so sorry to tell you this. You can't know what we look like.
I'm not sorry.
I think it should be illegal to see podcast people's faces because every time I see podcast people's faces, I get very weirded out. I'm like, no, you're a disembodied voice. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I'm going to make sure that no one ever sees my face because I don't want to weird you guys out.
No one can see your face in life. Like, you are now faceless.
I've become the faceless man.
Anyway, Obi-Wan, immediately get off topic. Okay. Sugar is so smart. I don't know if our listeners know this, but Faye and I know this.
She's the smartest.
She's the smartest. And has boiled Obi-Wan down to like three essential parts, and we're going to talk about all of those today. Should we say all of them? Or just jump in?
Yeah.
Be like, you can guess.
Say it up front, like the thesis of this podcast episode.
All right, so people who know me know I think a lot about Obi-Wan. He's kind of just lives there rent-free. So I ended up deciding that the top three components to Obi-Wan, the ones that I thought were most essential to his character, were this contrast of the good father versus bad father theme that obviously primarily comes up with Anakin, but obviously Obi-Wan as the good father kind of gets explored in some of his other relationships as well. The fact that he is kind of considered the ultimate Jedi, and just the kind of flaw in the character trait of faith and how that gets explored with Obi-Wan and how it sort of ties into the other two aspects of his character. And just to put it out there, because we didn't mention it earlier, but there are going to be some spoilers for the Obi-Wan Kenobi show from 2022, as well as, I mean, literally everything else that Obi-Wan shows up in like, higher canon.
Which is a lot of things.
Which is pretty much everything except, like, the sequels. But
spoilers for Star Wars!
Spoilers for Star Wars! But... Yeah. So I figured I'd start us off with good father versus bad father, because I feel like it's one of the first things that sort of comes up with Obi-Wan, obviously within the original trilogy, like that comparison is really prevalent. It's something that I know Lucas talked about as like a really important aspect of Star Wars and this character, that Vader is the bad father, Ben Kenobi is the good father. He's trying to make a modern fairy tale to sort of, you know, teach children about good and evil and things like that. And so I think that this comparison and this contrast between Obi-Wan and Vader at the time ends up really important and kind of central to the way he comes off in the original trilogy. Obviously his relationship to Luke and Leia, his relationships to Luke in the original trilogy, then Leia in the Kenobi show, where he obviously has a very positive relationship. He's sort of one of the primary mentor guiding characters that they have. He sort of provides that good option, you know, the option of light and balance and being a Jedi, against the worse option of being like their biological father, like Anakin.
I like that they named the bad father literally bad father, like dark
father. Yeah.
They really did.
They're like, what are we going to name our evil character who represents the bad father? Oh, we know what you name him? Bad father.
Bad father. Great.
Beautiful.
It's not subtle.
It's not subtle. I mean, we all say that, but like none of us would have known German when we were watching. Yeah. Like I'm sure a lot of people who watch this who are English speakers were like, sure, yeah, Darth Vader just sounds cool. Mm-hmm. Like you might be able to pick on Darth and Dark, but
we can't all be Anna Kendrick and Pitcher.
I was literally gonna say that. It's interesting that you have Kenobi as a good father when Luke and Leia both have like really good adopted fathers. That's like, he still plays such an important role in their life, probably because, to be fair, they do both lose their foster parents at like kind of the same time,
almost at the same time. Yeah. So it's, yeah, and I mean that's something I think that is explored a little bit more in the Kenobi show with regards to the Organas, and their Leia's relationship to them than it is with the Larses. The Larses come up in the Kenobi show as well, but like I feel like the Larses' relationship with Luke is not underdeveloped, but just like kind of underexplored by fandom at large from the original trilogy version of it.
It is interesting that both Anakin and Obi-Wan have a similar place in their children's lives, and that they come into their lives largely after their parents are dead. They're like the main parents who actually raise them. They come into lives after the parents are dead, and they represent these like kind of choices for where they can go in life, like the bad father, the good father, like the good path and the bad path. Like Obi-Wan is representing the kind of Jedi that Luke can be, and Vader is representing the kind of Jedi or Sith that Luke could be instead. Like there's these two options laid out before him. And in a similar way with Leia in the Kenobi show, she is no longer with her parents. She's away from the safety of her home for the first time, and her choices, she didn't really have choices here, but like the people that she's being torn between is Obi-Wan, who's trying to get her to safety, and Vader's trying to hunt her down to like do whatever. I don't know what their plan was.
Be fair, Vader's not doing shit all with Leia. He does not care. No, but
it's true. It's more like Reva via proxy. It's like a complicated thing, but it is interesting that like the two times that like Obi-Wan comes into these children's lives is when they are away from their parents for like the first time.
Yeah, I will say that if we want to talk about the Kenobi show and Leia, that like her big arc is choosing the Organa. You know, she starts off the show uncertain about her place in that family and sort of, she seems to be wondering a lot about her biological parents. She responds really quickly when it starts becoming clear that Obi-Wan might know more about her, might have a history with her that she's not aware of, and she starts thinking that he might be her father. But that over the course of the show, she starts realizing that, like, she doesn't need that. She doesn't need the connection to her biological family. It doesn't matter. And that she can choose to be an Organa because these are the people who chose her. And her relationship with Obi-Wan is sort of guiding her back towards that path. Because the two of them are kind of guiding each other back to where they're supposed to be. And for Obi-Wan, that's back to being a Jedi. And for Leia, it's towards that, you know, her destiny of being an Organa. And, you know, that both of them have to let go of Anakin, you know, in whatever concept he exists for them. Obviously with Leia, it's very nebulous because she doesn't have a name. She knows shit all about him. But she has to let go of this concept of her biological parents in order to sort of pursue her own destiny. And she does this by sort of creating this father-daughter relationship with Obi-Wan where you can call it father-daughter, but it's also in more ways like almost like a master Padawan, right? That he is guiding her down that path more than he is trying to parent her. You know, and obviously Kenobi shows a lot of comparisons between Leia and Anakin and how he failed Anakin, but can save Leia. You know, he obviously saves a lot of people over the course of this show. He kind of, you know, makes up for the failure that is Anakin in more than one way. But, I think it's less about choosing between Obi-Wan and Anakin and more about, like, how does she become who she's supposed to be via this guidance from Obi-Wan.
It is interesting, like, because both Luke and Leia grew up with regular parents, and then Obi-Wan is, like, a bonus person in their lives. And it's interesting that, like, they end up being very successful. And for Anakin, he starts out with, like, a more traditional parent, like, who loves him dearly, and then, like, he gets Obi-Wan instead. And I feel like there's an element there of, like, Obi-Wan is never the kind of traditional parent ever. Like, he's just not good at that role. That's never his job. He's always there for, like, a master Padawan kind of relationship to, like, be a guiding person. And that works for most of the time when, like, either they don't need it because they've never grown up with it, like a regular Ahsoka Padawan youngling, or like Luke and Leia, who they have that with somebody else. But with Anakin, it's like a kind of like a complicated thing there, because Anakin is looking for that kind of relationship to replace what he has lost. And Obi-Wan is not that kind of person. He's not that kind of, like, support for him. And he shouldn't be, because that's not what his job is. But it's interesting, like, shift in dynamics there, where, like, every time that Obi-Wan has succeeded in this role, it's because it's either not needed by the Padawan or it is already being fulfilled by other people. He is very good at this very specific thing, and he's not good at actually being, like, a more traditional supportive parent, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if we have gotten into this on the podcast in particular, and we can hit it, obviously, in more detail later, but the Jedi obviously are a family, but they're a non-traditional family. They work very differently, you know, they raise the children more communally, so it's not that they don't have, you know, very supportive, very caring, you know, almost parent-like, you know, relationships with the children at large, but it is a different kind of relationship than your more traditional, you know, like, nuclear family, parent to child sort of dynamic, and that's just what Anakin is used to. And so he struggles more when put into a situation where that's not this, it's not quite what he's getting anymore. He doesn't adjust to the more communal aspect as well.
Yeah, that's what Obi-Wan's really good at. He's really good at parenting communally. That's a good word for it. Thank you. Like, He's a very good communal parent. He is not a good single parent. He cannot be a single mom working 9 to 5. That's not his job.
Right. And it's like, you know, it's just not what's on offer, you know, which doesn't make him a bad parent, obviously. And he is supposed to be the good father. And I believe he still is, obviously, to Anakin.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
But that Anakin has just gotten used to something else. And because Anakin is what Anakin is, he's unwilling to let go of that. And embrace the Jedi's way of raising their children. While we're on the subject of Anakin, obviously Obi-Wan, you know, like, he's not a parent specifically, but, you know, I think he fulfills the narrative role of good father there still, but instead of being against Anakin, obviously, he's up against Palpatine as sort of the bad father in the prequels. Which is kind of fun to have that same dynamic almost replicated, but just he's up against a different Sith this time and, you know, raising the one that he will be up against in the next trilogy. And the ways that you see those two kind of battling and, you know, still representing the same way he did for Luke and Leia, obviously primarily Luke in the original trilogy, this idea of, like, what you should be versus, like, the temptation towards the darkness. You know, that Obi-Wan represents the harder path, the balance, and all of that for Anakin, and Anakin makes the wrong choice while Luke makes the right choice.
I think you could also argue that when, like, the relationship that he has with Luke and Leia are both, like, they have both consciously chosen that relationship knowing exactly what it is. Like, Luke goes into it knowing that he's not replacing his father, he's going to be, like, his Jedi mentor, and, like, we saw in the Kenobi show, Leia chooses the Organas and is like, I also have this other person that has this, like, parental role. Anakin chooses to go with the Jedi's, not, first of all, not to go with Obi-Wan specifically. He's going with Qui-Gon. So, like, already it's a different relationship. And he also doesn't let go of the fact that, like, he's leaving Shmi behind. And so it's a different relationship already. Just because they're going into it, like, choosing different things. And for Anakin, what he's trying to choose is, like, not on the table.
I think the other thing for me with Anakin is that he spends a lot more time with Obi-Wan than either Luke or Leia do. Anakin has a lot more time to grow disgruntled, and Anakin is much younger. And so, you know, the adjustment perhaps is a little bit harder for him than it is for, say, Luke in particular, who is an adult already. Already, like, gunning to leave the house. He doesn't really need a parental relationship in the same way anymore. He's not looking for that kind of, like, everyday 24/7 support from a parent. He actually doesn't want it. And so it's the relationship with Obi-Wan, which is a very brief, but, you know, is a little bit more of a distant kind of mentor-mentee relationship, is exactly what Luke needs at this point in his life. You know, because he's at a different place on his journey than Anakin was, you know, had Luke, you know, attempted to wander off and become Obi-Wan's little student at 10 years old. Who knows how that would have turned out for him?
I mean, we do see that he does get frustrated with Owen and Beru for, like, not letting him, like, go off and leave on his own. Like, it's not like Luke is immune to being frustrated with his parental figures. Right. It's just that Obi-Wan is only his, like, father figure, mentor figure for, like, what, like, 2 days before he dies?
Yeah, and he's not trying to be a father. Luke's not looking for a father. He's like, I'm done. I'm ready to leave the nest. Whereas Anakin, you know, while he obviously makes a very intentional choice to walk away from his mother, was, perhaps you could argue, not necessarily ready to leave the nest. And that, you know, kind of entering into this relationship is not something he was ready for. There's also the aspect that potentially Padawans aren't taken until they're a little older, that Anakin is actually quite young to be a Padawan. You know, that obviously Clone Wars has Ahsoka at 14 being, discussed as a little young to be a Padawan. And so, you know, the concept of an apprenticeship is actually something that, like, is in Star Wars world building as something sort of almost more of adult relationship, you know, that they don't enter into it until they are older. And whereas Anakin gets taken on so young that, you know, he perhaps hasn't been given that chance. He's not ready to adjust into an adult apprenticeship relationship.
And then when we get into, like, the Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan situationship, we have, like, a whole thing, because they have been master and apprentice for a very long time. And Obi-Wan is 25 when he graduates from that Padawanship. He is he's very adult. Like, his brain is fully formed. He's all good to go. Like, he's set. But he's not that much older than Luke is when he joins up with Obi-Wan. But it's implied that, like, he's too old to be a Padawan when Yoda meets him. So, like, we have that dynamic there with, like, Obi-Wan is, like, clearly very ready to be on his own and be a knight, but Qui-Gon is still clinging to that. And they get into that a little bit in, like, the extra books that you've read, Sugar.
The Jedi Apprentice stuff?
Yeah, like, a little bit later, like, Qui-Gon's, like, not letting go of their relationship, even though, like, Obi-Wan is ready, so Obi-Wan doesn't think he's ready because Qui-Gon doesn't think he's ready.
I mean, it can kind of go either way. It's obviously ambiguous enough in the film that it's unclear whether Obi-Wan is attempting to leave the nest a little early, and Qui-Gon is like, you know, like, give it another couple months, you know, like, let's just finish a couple things off. Or if Qui-Gon is actually clinging to Obi-Wan a little bit, or the opposite, you know, that Obi-Wan perhaps is, like, clinging just enough to Qui-Gon that Qui-Gon knows maybe he's not ready, and so he's kind of extending it a little bit right up until he is kind of left with very little options but to try to put Obi-Wan up for his trials. But, I mean, it is interesting because we don't quite know enough about their relationship within canon, you know, within the film, to sort of make a firm call either way on who it is that is clinging at all, if there's anybody.
I mean, I could, and people have written essays on the look that Obi-Wan gives Qui-Gon when Qui-Gon's like, actually, Obi-Wan's ready for the trials, I'm gonna take Anakin as my apprentice. Like, that look that he gives him, like, he looks so betrayed. It's beautiful cinema, first of all, because there's so many layers to their relationship that you just, like, don't know about. They clearly have such a long history, and, like, we just don't know it. And it's so fascinating. There's a reason they wrote so many books about it, and, like, there's so many fanfics about them, because they're such an interesting relationship. They have such a weird dynamic, because basically they're one person split into two, like, metaphysically, like, that is what they are. Like, there's a character that's been split into two different characters to make the dynamic in The Phantom Menace more interesting, and that makes their character dynamic between them fascinating, because they're one person split into two, but at the same time they're very different.
Yeah. And just some additional context for people who might not know, like I did not, not that long ago. Qui-Gon's role within The Phantom Menace was actually originally Obi-Wan's. Like, Obi-Wan was going to be the older character, and he was going to have Qui-Gon as this other apprentice. who was much younger, and presumably something would have happened to Qui-Gon, and so that Obi-Wan and Anakin would come together. And this was true for such a long time that I believe if, like, the scripts that got put released to, like, the early Academy or something that you can find still have Obi-Wan's name on some of Qui-Gon's dialogue. And so, like, it was a kind of a very last-minute switchover in the narrative to have Qui-Gon as this older mentor character and Obi-Wan as the younger Padawan, and it has a really interesting impact on who Obi-Wan ended up becoming, because he obviously has that that line within the original trilogy in Return of the Jedi where he claims that, you know, he took on Anakin out of arrogance, and he sort of blames himself for trying to teach Anakin better than Yoda, and that it was a kind of a level of hubris, but that with when you actually look at Phantom Menace, like, that's not at all how that worked. And that Qui-Gon is the character who seems potentially a little bit arrogant. That's something that I know Lucas has kind of mentioned a few times in the audio commentaries, that, like, Qui-Gon is making a mistake in some ways in trying to train Anakin, that the Jedi aren't wrong about Anakin. And it just, it's such an interesting dynamic between them, but it also just has such a, like, wild impact on who Obi-Wan becomes as a character.
Yeah, especially because, like, because Qui-Gon is meant to be, like, originally starts out as an Obi-Wan prequel, you can kind of see in some ways, like, how OG flavored Obi-Wan is, has grown into some of his master's traits in some ways. Like, he's very cryptic, he's very, like, only talks in, like, kind of vague terms sometimes. Like, he's like, the Force is, like, oh, mysterious, but also luck doesn't matter. Like, it's just, it's a fun little thing where you can, like, see where there are, like, parallels between them, and it's fun to be like, oh, okay, so, like, Obi-Wan has grown into this person who is a lot like his master.
Yeah, as opposed to just, like, Obi-Wan's always been like this. It's like, no, there's a journey that he's taken from being this kind of younger and more impetuous person to becoming the wiser, good father character, because I guess that's the thing we should have hit earlier, is that Qui-Gon kind of exists as the good father character to Obi-Wan. You know, that this is where he learned to be that person for Anakin, and then later for Luke and Leia. Do we want to discuss Ahsoka, or do we want to skip her?
We can talk about Ahsoka. I feel like we skip Ahsoka a lot, because you did talk about her a lot recently. But, you know, that was like 3 months ago. It's time. We can talk about Ahsoka again.
So Ahsoka is an interesting character, because obviously she is assigned to Anakin and not to Obi-Wan. So Obi-Wan has this kind of, like, impact on her that is a little bit from the side. I know that there is the one episode in Clone Wars where he calls her their Padawan, that they're sort of training her together, but she obviously is much more closely associated with Anakin than with Obi-Wan, and that, you know, it's one line in one episode, and it's not something that's been brought up really anywhere else, like in Rebels or the recent Ahsoka show. And so one of the things that's most interesting to me about Ahsoka is that, you know, intentionally or not, there is this kind of impact of Ahsoka having a closer relationship to the bad father figure of Anakin and of Palpatine, sort of through Anakin, that Palpatine has manipulated Anakin enough that we actually see a lot more of Palpatine's manipulations getting passed on to Ahsoka within their relationship than we do Obi-Wan's, you know, more healthy dynamic and philosophies and stuff. That Ahsoka's got some of that already as a Jedi Foundation, but that I feel like the most interesting part of Ahsoka is that she was raised by the bad father for a while in a way that nobody else was.
She's got some influences there, which I feel like they could do so much with. Like, if they had actually, we don't need to talk about Ahsoka show again, but I will just say really quickly that if they had actually decided to make Ahsoka a complicated character in her own fucking show, they could have done a lot of things like, oh, she learned a lot from somebody who became a Sith, a very bad person, and he learned a lot from somebody who was the worst Sith ever. Like, there's a lot of trickle down here of things that she maybe has needed to unlearn, and she could talk about that with her new apprentice. And they didn't do that because, you know, why would they do something interesting?
Yeah, because they...
a Star Wars show.
And also because Filoni doesn't see it.
Does he need to have a conversation with me? Because, listen, just because I love him doesn't mean I don't admit that he's a bad person. And he needs to have a come-to-Jesus moment where he comes to the realization that Anakin, well-beloved and adorable and fantastic, has made bad choices. Beautiful people...
Good character, bad person.
Exactly. Beautiful people can be bad, too. It's okay. Controversial take over here.
Yeah. So yeah, I think there's a very interesting, almost probably unintentional effect on Ahsoka as a character by her being so associated with the bad father more than the good father, that I think is just really interesting to view, even though I am like 99% certain that Filoni does not think of it this way at all. And it's just because he keeps glorifying the bad father that Ahsoka has sort of ended up in this very weird, interesting position.
Speaking of glorifying characters, Obi-Wan, as I have just recently, I know that you both know this, but our listeners don't, I just recently watched A New Hope for the first time in probably 15 years.
I'm so happy for you.
And that was an experience, for sure, because I watched the prequels multiple months ago. And so it was very interesting to see Obi-Wan as, like, an example of a Jedi in the original, like, the very first time that an audience is being introduced to a Jedi. And it makes sense to me that from that people would say, this is how we're going to base all of our opinions about Jedis, like, on this one person. I don't have more thoughts about it.
No, that's a great thought.
That's it.
That's a beautiful thought.
It's certainly a good introduction. And I think it is interesting to look. And that's kind of why I came up with this particular section, is that I think that is very true, that, you know, he is the first Jedi we're ever that audiences would have been introduced to. He was technically not the first Jedi I was ever introduced to. Although he comes in right with Qui-Gon, so I'm introduced to him and Qui-Gon at about the same time, if you watch Phantom Menace first. But in 1977, obviously, he was the first Jedi that audiences would have ever been introduced to, as well as, obviously, all our characters. Like, Luke has never met a Jedi before. This is the first time that he is getting introduced to one. And so Obi-Wan sort of has to be the embodiment of what a Jedi should be and is, because there is nothing else. And I think that has had an interesting sort of effect on his character moving forward, as well as on perception of the Jedi overall. Because if he's supposed to be the ultimate Jedi and he makes mistakes, like, what does that say? And how does that sort of speak to what the Jedi are supposed to be? And a lot of different writers have taken very different tracks with Obi-Wan in how they choose to work that aspect of him in, because I think everyone sort of has picked up on that Obi-Wan is supposed to be this, like, almost perfect Jedi. Not everyone handles it well, though.
I do think it's interesting that Obi-Wan, like, kind of becomes a more flawed and well-rounded character by the third one, where he's, like, talking to Luke and, like, admitted that he has made mistakes and, like, all these things. And I feel like that's some of where, like, the whole, oh, the Jedi Order was flawed, like, comes from, because everyone is viewing Obi-Wan as, like, a representative of the entire Jedi Order. So therefore, if he has made mistakes, then obviously the whole Order is flawed. And, like, you can kind of, like, follow that through line, that thought through to, like, their conclusions, even though it doesn't actually make a lot of sense. But you can, like, they only have, like, two examples of Jedi for 30 years, not quite 30 years, but almost 30 years to, like, base these assumptions off of. So you can kind of see where, like, okay, well, if Obi-Wan is the best Jedi, then, and one of the only Jedis we have, and he is flawed, then obviously all the Jedi must be similarly flawed. Which isn't really fair, because the Jedi themselves are all very different people, and the Order lasts for a very long time.
Right, and that's, of course, like we were mentioning earlier, with how Obi-Wan being replaced sort of with Qui-Gon in the prequels means that line he has where he admits to having made a mistake has suddenly become something where it's like, well, he thinks it's a mistake, but he didn't, you know? Whereas, obviously, like, as far as we knew in the original trilogy, this was a completely valid thing for him to say and believe, you know, that, like, yeah, sure, Obi-Wan made a mistake. He thought he could train Anakin as well as Yoda. He was wrong, you know, that this was a legitimate mistake he had made. And then you get to the prequels, and for whatever reason they chose to make a different choice, and now all of a sudden he didn't actually make that mistake at all. And it's just like, all right, you know, whatever. It like wildly changes Obi-Wan as a character, and it actually makes him a little less flawed in some ways, or it changes the flaw that he's a little bit more self-deprecating than, like, arrogant.
Yeah, I think you could maybe argue that when he is making the argument that Anakin must be trained and that he will be the one to train him, and he's absolutely insisting on this, you could make the argument that maybe one of his thought process was like, oh, well, I can do a great job of this because Master Qui-Gon trusted me, and so therefore I am the only one who can train this. He could have absolutely insisted that he must be trained by anybody else and presented himself as an option, but he insists that he must be the one to train him because he promised Qui-Gon. And so I guess you could kind of make that argument, but that's not very clear in the movie at all. Like, that's not very, like, strongly implied at all.
I wouldn't blame that as arrogance either. I'd probably line that up more as, like, desperation almost, you know, that he is, like, so impacted by Qui-Gon's death and his dying promise that it sort of has to be him now. But it's more about grief, you know, than it is about arrogance. It doesn't feel like arrogance in the film. You know, he's being very confident when he's speaking to Yoda, like, you know, I'll train Anakin myself if I have to. If, you know, I'll wander off. I'll leave the order to train him if I have to. He's being very confident about it. But I don't feel like it comes off as arrogance.
Man, that's a conversation you should have had with Anakin. Like, yeah, I did think about leaving the order once. For you! And they're having a conversation about Satine. Like, no, it wasn't Satine I was going to leave the order for, Anakin. I was going to leave the order for you, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that would have been a very interesting conversation to see them potentially have. But obviously that also has the additional potential bad impact of, like, you know, they might have only let you in to keep me. You know, which, I mean, like, isn't true, because I think Yoda kind of says, like, mate, we're already gonna let him in. It's just a question about who's training him at this point, and I'm not convinced it should be you. And that seems to be where Yoda's sitting in that scene in Phantom Menace, you know. And so it puts Obi-Wan in a funny position where it's like, doesn't need to be this weirdly confident about it, but he's already done it, so he kind of just lets that lie, and then Yoda decides to, you know, let it happen. He just kind of sighs and goes, fine, whatever.
I guess you can train and fulfill your promise to your dying master, whatever.
Let's see where this goes. But since you brought up Satine...
Oh, God. I was like, what if we don't talk about Satine? But we should.
So
we kind of have to.
When I said there were people who didn't handle this well.
Who could you have been referring to?
Yeah. Romances tend to be where Obi-Wan's storyline trips and falls a lot. Satine is obviously the main one, because Satine is the canon romantic love interest that he has had. The only other one I know particularly well is Ciri Tachi from the Jedi Apprentice series. I feel like I keep hearing about this Annalene person, who I believe is from a book set when he's on Tatooine, but I don't think it was an explicit romance. I think it was kind of like a, she had feelings for him and it doesn't really go anywhere. Tala Durith from the Kenobi show was also originally intended to be his love interest, and they ended up not going that direction, but I believe that the actors were aware, and the actress who played Tala kind of decided to keep in some of the romantic undertones to it, to kind of give this idea that Tala might be sort of into Obi-Wan, but she doesn't act on it before she ends up dying. It's just interesting the way that people keep wanting to give him this romance. They are dying to give Obi-Wan a romance.
Everyone's just in love with him. They can't help it. He's so beautiful.
I get it. I understand why people, like, allo-romantics are like, you should have this because I love you. It's like, okay, but consider
that it sucks most of the time.
Yeah, consider that it's a bad decision.
Because, like, for Obi-Wan as a character, he sits there as this ultimate Jedi, and we've been told within the context of the prequels primarily that they don't do these kinds of relationships. They love. They're perfectly happy to love people in pretty much any shape, you know, whether it's platonic, familial, even romantic, you know, that the feeling itself is really not an issue, but the committed relationship is a problem. And so if you decide to throw that in for Obi-Wan, it means that you usually have to then discuss why he's not going for it. Because obviously, in later, more canon stories, he clearly is not in a relationship. You know, he clearly doesn't have one. It's not an important aspect of his more, you know, Lucas-oriented storylines. And so you have to then explain why he gives up this relationship, and it usually gets wrapped into his being a Jedi and his being very dedicated to being a Jedi. And this can kind of work, but because we are a society, a metanormative society that really prioritizes romantic relationships above everything else, it lands you in this really awkward position where, like, the loss of this relationship is, like, fucking devastating. And Obi-Wan regrets it. He's super remorseful about it. He's almost resentful of having lost it. And it kind of puts his identity as a Jedi almost in question. And Satine is my worst example of this, primarily because Faye brought it up earlier, but his line where he claims that he would have left the Order for Satine. And the only reason he doesn't is because she didn't say the word. I am air quoting here because this is a direct quote, which Faye and Nat can see, but the listeners cannot.
Just, you can feel them, though. Like, you can feel them in your soul that they are there.
Satine doesn't say the word, and so he appears to have just stayed a Jedi. He does claim earlier that the reason they don't work out was because he had his duty as a Jedi, and she, you know, stayed whatever as a Duchess, and that his duty as a Jedi was what kept them apart, but he, you know, he says directly to her later that it's because she didn't say the word, and so it kind of sends this message that he only stays with the Jedi as, like, a conciliatory second prize, you know, that, like, he didn't really want to stay with the Jedi, but he didn't have another option if, you know, if he didn't, because Satine was not going to, like, accept him. And it's this really unfortunate implication. I'm not sure it was intended that way, but, like, they, you know, they're so intent on forcing Obi-Wan to keep this romantic thing as, like, one of the most important things that's ever happened to him, as opposed to insisting that his choice to remain a Jedi was more important than anything else. And it's like, if you're going to go that direction, it's just, it needs to be balanced really well between, you know, this other option that he has that causes him to leave or to consider leaving the Order, and his ultimate decision to stay and why he chooses to stay. And I just feel like it was badly mishandled with Satine. Ciri is on thin ice. I did read that very recently. And it is generally handled pretty well. There were a couple of nitpicky things I had about Ciri, but I think it's, like, miles above what happened with Satine. Satine, actually, the Obi-Wan and Satine relationship is at its best when she dies. not just because I dislike Satine, but because in that scene, she insists that he remain light, that he doesn't give in to darkness, as a result of her murder. And, you know, he makes this big speech to Maul afterwards that it takes more strength to resist darkness than to give in. And I think that that aspect works, but I dislike their relationship enough prior that it doesn't hit very well for me. There's a lot of people who fucking love Obi-Teen, though, so I'm, like, obviously in a minority in disliking them, but it hits me badly. We brought up Jedi Apprentice earlier, and I feel like that Jedi Apprentice is a better example of them handling it well, where Obi-Wan is struggling with his identity as a Jedi earlier on via his relationship to Qui-Gon primarily, and feels so much compassion for this one cause where it's just these children, like, struggling in a war zone, that he just wants to stay with them really badly, and he's, like, uncertain about his place as a Jedi enough that he's willing to leave the Order to pursue something that he thinks is going to be a better path for him. And it seems to go well for a minute, and then it all goes really sour, and Qui-Gon has to be called back in to kind of help out and fix the situation, and Obi-Wan sees that and realizes, no, that's what I want to be. That's what I want to do. I want to be someone who can effectively bring peace to a people who can't find it themselves, and I don't want to be stuck doing that only on one planet. I want to be able to bring that to the galaxy. And that realization causes him to choose to go back to the Order and continue his training under Qui-Gon, despite the uncertainties that exist. And so he has to let go of a lot of his fears and the attachments that he has to his idea of what being a Jedi should be from before. And it just, like, it doesn't minimize the impact of Melodon and the children that he met there and how much he wanted to help them, but they utilized the impact of that to explain why being a Jedi was so important to him. And I thought that that was actually a really well done version of that. And it's not romantic, you'll notice. Shocking how that works out. But
so weird.
So weird. But yeah, I think that like, there's a lot of things that are weird about the Jedi Apprentice novels and a lot of things that I could nitpick about that as well. But I think that just is probably my favorite example of Obi-Wan kind of going through this journey towards becoming the ultimate Jedi as a younger person, and this person exploring why he would have gotten there, what could have started him down that path.
I think it's hard to have a character that has already been set up as a very specific thing in the original trilogy and then try to build on it without, like, contradicting it.
Yeah.
And I think, like, ultimately he has to make the same choices at the end. He has to choose light instead of dark. That's his, like, purpose as a character, as a foil to Anakin. And there are only so many ways that, like, it, threading that needle is really hard. To be like, let's make you interesting, but not not different enough to not be the character that you, like, started as.
Yeah.
That wasn't well articulated.
No, I feel you, though. And I think that's the problem a lot of people had with the Kenobi show. And, I mean, I think that the Kenobi show handled this relatively well, but I know that there were people who struggled with it. Because Obi-Wan does feel very different at the beginning of the Kenobi show, and I think that's something that you kind of mentioned. And we can tie this into Faith so that we can move on from this particular section and go into the next one. But that Obi-Wan has, like, lost all faith by the time he gets there, and that's something that's very not Obi-Wan-like. It's not Jedi-like. He's no longer the ultimate Jedi at the beginning of the Kenobi show, because he's just lost so much that he's no longer who he is, and he has to go on this journey to regain that sense of identity. And I think people were, like, so off-put by how out of character he was at the beginning of the show that it was just, like, jarring, because you expect Obi-Wan to be a certain way, and he was not acting like it.
Yeah, but I feel like people have to recognize that progress is not always linear. Mm-hmm. And while it often is in fictional media, because it is stories and we like to have stories have, like, regular progression, it is not unrealistic for a person to regress that much and then have to build back up again. That happens regularly. And so I like that they did that for Kenobi, to be like, this was someone who's been through a large trauma. And yes, it is realistic for them to go from that to A New Hope, like, 20 years later. And that's fine. We can just stick with that. But what if he did regress? And what if he did have to build himself back up again in this manner? That's still a very realistic thing for this character or this person to go through.
Also the first time Obi-Wan's a main character and not the side character, which sort of requires that he go through development at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That was something that I super noticed, because I basically, like, in terms of the Star Wars media I was consuming, I watched the Kenobi show and then I watched A New Hope. And it, to me, felt like he caught me off guard in A New Hope, and I'm sure that's not the way that people think about it, because other people are more familiar with that one, which is so fine. Like, you're right. But it was funny to me that he, like, in Kenobi, he is very obviously a person who has lost his faith, and then by the time you get to A New Hope, he is, like, killing people on Tatooine when he wasn't pulling out his lightsaber before. It was literally, like, buried in the desert. He sees Luke about to escape the Death Star and, like, kind of stops fighting Vader and lets himself be killed, which maybe is a hot take for me to say that that's how that scene goes, but that's how I interpreted it.
Oh, I think that's accurate.
He kind of gives up. Like, not gives up, but he, in A New Hope, is very much not a main character. He is there to be, like, the guiding force for Luke. And in Kenobi, because the focus is on his journey, I'm like, yeah, of course he has to have a journey. Because in A New Hope, he just knows everything. He's there to know everything and guide Luke and set up Luke's story rather than have his own.
I do really love his, like, little smirk right before he, like, raises his lightsaber to let Vader cut him down. Because he's like, oh my god, you're going to be so annoyed by this. Like, you're going to be so annoyed you don't know what's happening. It's going to be so funny. Like, I love his little smirk at Vader right there. It's perfect. Like, I don't know if that's what they're originally intending to do with that scene, but I love it. It works so well for me.
It's really good.
I feel like the interpretation I've seen the most often is that he's trying to provide a distraction. That he sees, yes, Luke and Leia coming out, and he's like, oh, they need to escape. And if I try to join them, he's like, Vader's going to follow me. And then we're all like, they're fucked. You know, there's no way they're escaping on that ship without Vader, like, following them onto it if Obi-Wan tries to run. And so, you know, kind of the only thing he can do to try and ensure that Luke and Leia have an opportunity to get away without Vader following them is to sort of effectively offer himself up as a sacrifice.
Sure, but, like, he doesn't have to die for it. Like, he could have just been like, all right, I give up. Like, he could have just been, like, surrendered as his prisoner. But he's like, no. The funniest thing to do would be to ghost right now.
Yeah, I feel like the implication is that Vader's never going to do that. that he's he's never going to not take the opportunity to try to kill him, that if given the option here, he is going to kill him. I've seen people interpret it as Obi-Wan kind of giving him one last chance, right? That, like, he could do that. He could take him prisoner. You know, because Obi-Wan's not telling, forcing him to kill him. You know, he just puts his lightsaber up. He basically surrenders, and it's like, Anakin can do what he wants from there. And, you know, he makes the wrong choice again, because it's Anakin.
I have read some delightful fan fiction where he does not kill him and, like, takes him back to his room and, like, hides him from the Emperor, and it's very funny. They usually do end up kissing, but, like, that's not important. The funny part is him hiding him in his room from the Emperor.
Sounds so unfortunate. He would never be detected.
The thing that I noticed the most that felt different, like, in A New Hope versus, like, the Kenobi show and also the prequels, is that, the one line that stuck out to me the most is when they're on the Death Star and he's, like, going off to do whatever, to, like, pull down the shields or whatever. I watched this so recently, and I've already forgotten so much. He says to Luke, "The Force will be with you," not "May the Force be with you." And that was so interesting to me because I was like, I feel like in this one line you've encapsulated how confident this person is in the Force and in his faith in it. Like, he knows what's happening. He's in control of the situation. Like, he is basically manifesting a good outcome for Luke rather than just, like hoping for it.
Yeah, he's become the ultimate Jedi Master, and I think that that's a journey that, like, they've spent a long time now kind of building him up to, obviously, with the prequels and then Clone Wars to some degree, and most recently the Kenobi show, that you see him kind of going on this journey from baby to ultimate Jedi Master, and primarily through that theme of faith that, you know, earlier on, one of the things that happens with his relationship with Qui-Gon is that Qui-Gon has just so much faith in the Force, right? That he is also the kind of person who would be like, "The Force will be with you." I'm not sure he ever actually specifically uses that phrase, but he absolutely is, like, certain that he knows what the Force's will is. And just acts on it, you know, and he gets considered a maverick for it, but, you know, he's very, very confident in that, and it's something that Obi-Wan struggles with a little bit more, and I think that's part of why he is so confident when he speaks to Yoda by the end, is because he's kind of trying to emulate Qui-Gon and Qui-Gon's faith by the end of the film, and, you know, then you get into Attack of the Clones, where it's like he's got a little bit more faith in general, but it's more than about having faith in Anakin, that he's, like, not certain Anakin is ready, and granted, he's right not to be sure that Anakin is ready, but as a character, he needs to learn to let go and let Anakin make his own mistakes and just have faith that his own training has been enough, and that Anakin will potentially make mistakes, but that he can fix them himself now, you know, or that he will ask for help if he needs it, yada yada yada. And so then you get to Revenge of the Sith, where he's got, like, utmost faith in Anakin. And I've seen people take this to be like, oh, he's, like, so attached to Anakin now. He's too soft on Anakin. And I'm like, no, that's not the point. Like, the point is that he's learned to have faith in Anakin, that even if Anakin makes mistakes, he will grow from that. He will pick himself back up. He'll do better next time. And he's just got that utmost faith in Anakin, and it's actually the opposite of an attachment. He's let go of a lot of his worries for Anakin.
I think there's, like, instead of Obi-Wan believing that he could train Anakin better than Yoda, what he really believes is that his training will be enough for Anakin to choose the light side over the dark side. It ends up not being. It ends up being the dark side and Palpatine are more seductive than Obi-Wan's training could prepare him for, and that Anakin had internalized enough of it to be ready for that. Because he ended up not being ready for that, obviously. And I feel like that is something that, like, Obi-Wan doesn't know, because he doesn't know the circumstances of Anakin's fall. Like, he never knows exactly what happened to make Anakin fall. That is never a conversation him and Anakin have. He does not have Force visions about it. Like, nothing. He has no idea what happened. The most he knows is, like, the conversation that he has with Padme, like, talking out there before he's eavesdropping on the ship. That's it. Like, he has no idea what happened. And so, like, he has to kind of draw his own conclusions. And so, like, his incorrect conclusion is that, like, well, maybe I didn't train him enough. But he did. It's not his fault that Anakin didn't internalize his own shit. Like, he didn't learn the lessons. It's not Obi-Wan's fault for not teaching him, because he did teach him everything he needed to know.
Right. Yeah. It's such an interesting change to his character, that it's not arrogance, really, you know, that he thinks he can train Anakin better than anyone else, but just this determination to sort of live up to the example that Qui-Gon set, in just having this faith in Anakin, not just as the chosen one, but as a person. You know, and that he actually exceeds Qui-Gon in that almost, because Qui-Gon primarily believes in Anakin as the chosen one, right? That's sort of where most of his faith tends to lie. He likes Anakin, but
he doesn't know him. He met this kid like 2 days ago. Like, his belief in him is entirely based on his belief in the Force and in the prophecy, not based on Anakin as a person. Obi-Wan's belief in Anakin is entirely, almost entirely, based on who Anakin is as a person. Exactly. Like, he doesn't really care about the prophecy.
He does care about the prophecy by Revenge of the Sith, in the sense that, like, he believes in Anakin so much as a person that he's like, if he is the Chosen One, which he very well could be, and obviously, you know, from a meta universe he is, like, if he is the Chosen One, he's gonna do this. We have to believe in him as both in order to trust him at all. You know, that's kind of the conversation he has with Mace and Yoda, you know, that it's the converse of the conversation that they had in Attack of the Clones, where they're it's Mace telling him, like, if he is the Chosen One, you have to believe he's gonna do the prophecy's thing. You know, you just have to believe that that's how that's gonna work out, and you don't have any control over that. And then, of course, you come around to Revenge of the Sith, where, you know, they're kind of going, like, man, maybe we misunderstood that prophecy, you know, and it's Obi-Wan going, like, no. No, we have to keep our faith. We have to keep faith in him. And of course, that faith is not rewarded at all in any way, shape, or form. Anakin defies his fate. He defies that prophecy. And it goes nowhere, which means it works really well to get to the Kenobi show, like Nat was saying, and he is lost it. Entirely. It's gone. Because he had so much. He built that up. He believed so hard. And Anakin ruined it. And it's just, like, devastating. And so then you have to see him build that faith back up throughout the Kenobi show, so that he can come back to the original trilogy and be someone who has faith again. And I think that the Kenobi show actually does really well at that, going, like, yeah, of course he's lost everything. Of course he's not who he used to be. He's fucked up. He got massively screwed by someone he believed in so deeply. And now he has to try and have faith again, that same kind of faith in, like, Luke and Leia. And he's starting to put all of his hopes on Luke in this almost unhealthy way. And that's kind of what Owen is picking up on, obviously, that, like, Obi-Wan is trying to have faith, but he doesn't really have it. So he's kind of faking it till he makes it, and it's not working. And it's devastating until he finally realizes that, like, he didn't have control over Anakin. He didn't fail Anakin. He just didn't have any control over the choices Anakin made. And he's not going to have any control over Luke or Leia's either. And he just... all he can do, again, is have faith. And within the Kenobi show, that faith starts to be rewarded. Faith in Haja, in Tala, in Roken, obviously, in Leia, in Reva, you know, that he starts to see that, like, Anakin was a fucking one-off. You know? Like, yes, Anakin failed, but that doesn't mean everybody around him will.
I feel like he has to separate out his faith in what he believed Anakin was supposed to do and, like, in the prophecy a little bit, and, like, be like, okay, that failed, but that doesn't mean that, like, everything is lost. The prophecy, maybe it didn't apply to Anakin, that's not really important. The important thing is that, like, there is still hope for this galaxy, and it is in these people that I am meeting that are helping me as I go, and I can still have faith in the Force, even though Anakin destroyed, like, everything by choosing not to, like, go through with what I taught him. Like, there is still hope for this through these people, and I can still believe in the Force and not feel incredibly stupid.
I think that adds, like, for me seeing the Kenobi show and then A New Hope. Did you guys know that I did that? I think I've said it to seven times in this episode that I've done that. Yeah, for me, when I watch Kenobi and then A New Hope, it felt like it added more depth to his confidence in A New Hope. And, like, his actions could have very easily come across as arrogant coming from nowhere, like, for me personally. And knowing that he had this journey where he had a lot of faith in the Force and then was deeply betrayed and lost it and had to work to regain it, made it feel like more earned confidence by the time you get there where he says, I know what my role in this is going to be. And it's not the main character. It's, like, a supporting role. And I feel like I have the confidence that I'm not going to fail because, like, the only thing I can control is my own choices. And I'm going to choose to do this for Luke.
I love how much he believes in Luke. It's very sweet.
It's very cute. I think the arrogance works for the character as they sort of created him within the original trilogy, right? That, like, they follow up on that within Return of the Jedi by him being arrogant and taking Anakin on. But that, like, mm-hmm. it's changed so much over the years since then that it no longer comes off as arrogance, but, like, confidence, right? It's faith, it's confidence, that these nuance added from the prequels, Clone Wars, the Kenobi show, any of the books people want to take into their canon, has sort of built Obi-Wan out of this sort of more arrogant place that he actually does kind of have in the original trilogy, and into something even more, that that faith sort of does allow him to almost hit that ultimate Jedi role even better than he used to. And it's just, it's really interesting to sort of see how his character has evolved over the years. And he doesn't feel like he's come that far from where he first ended up, but, you know, in other ways he's changed really radically.
It's kind of like a roller coaster. Like, yes, he's ended up pretty close to where he started out, but that doesn't mean the journey in between was not fucking wild.
Yeah, I think you said it really well when you said, like, this is not a linear journey for him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I do kind of wish that there was more acknowledgement in the Kenobi show of, like, Obi-Wan coming to the realization that Palpatine was also to blame for what happened. Like, there's not really recognition of, like, what Palpatine's effect on Anakin was for Obi-Wan. Like, he's recognizing that, like, Obi-Wan is responsible for his own choices, but there's not really any, like, oh, Palpatine was also there influencing him, and, like, that's part of the reason. There's no blame put on Palpatine for Obi-Wan, which I wish there was more of. I wish there was more of Anakin and Palpatine's relationship in most things, but I wish there was more of that recognition for Obi-Wan to be like, I'm not totally blamed for this. Palpatine was also there, and he fucked it up. I did a great job, and he ruined it. Like, he was coming around digging out the foundation after me. Rude. Like, I wish there was just more of that, like, a dynamic, because I think that Palpatine thinks Obi-Wan's fucking annoying, and I think that it's a very funny dynamic.
I think Palpatine probably was originally going to kill Obi-Wan off specifically to throw Anakin into the darkness. I think that was his original plan.
I mean, he does. He has him killed on Utapa. It's not his fault it didn't work. Utapa? Utapau? Utapau. Thank you.
He well, yeah, but that's along with everyone else at that point, and he's already turned Anakin, but I feel like there are, like, before Padme comes back into the picture, I feel like there's this sense that, like, kind of was planning on killing Obi-Wan off to try and, like, throw Anakin into a tailspin and push him in, isolate him further and push him into darkness, that Obi-Wan is sort of, like, one of his strongest relationships, and eliminating Obi-Wan would have been really helpful for him. And so that's an interesting dynamic to kind of have there that, that doesn't get explored almost ever. But I like the idea of you know, Obi-Wan not finding out about Palpatine, but just kind of looking back and realizing how that relationship might have impacted Anakin. But on the other hand, I do like the lack of it, in the sense that, like, you know, Obi-Wan, even without all of the information, still has to let it go, that, like, he might never know the truth. He never does know the entire truth, you know, and so he can't necessarily place blame on anyone else, but he still has to let it go. And it just doesn't matter. He can't get stuck in the past, you know, even just to blame someone else. And I like that, like, they don't offer him Palpatine as a crutch, right? He has to, like, dig his way out of the pit he's put himself in on his own, you know, without, like, being able to go, oh, well, of course it's not my fault. It was Palpatine's fault.
Ugh, that's so much more healthy, Sugar. Jeez.
That's so much less dramatic than it could be.
But, yeah, I kind of like that, like, it almost doesn't matter. Right? Because, yes, Palpatine manipulated him, but it's more important to recognize that regardless of why Anakin did what he did, it was his choice anyway, and it's unhealthy for Obi-Wan to be so focused on that, and to like, just be focused on who to blame, and, you know, that he comes out of it because of his faith in other people, because the hope that they offer him, and these connections that he is making, and it's more about choosing to continue to love others than it is about choosing to hate Palpatine.
Because Obi-Wan's great. He did a great job. He's doing his best at all times, and he succeeded most of the time.
I now need to go find all of the, like, edits of just his one-liner. The amount of... I cannot explain to you how often I say, how did this happen? We're smarter than this, in my daily life. Like, multiple times a day, every day.
It's a great line.
It's a great line. It's very important to me. I hold it very dear to my heart, which is why, mostly why I wanted to celebrate him.
Do you have anybody telling you, apparently not, in return?
No.
That's devastating, because it makes the entire scene.
I know. Most of the time I say it to myself. That's probably why.
That's fair. That's fair.
So it's me that's slacking.
Would you guys like a goat fact?
I'm always. Goat fact.
Okay. Goats are one of the cleanest animals, and they are more selective feeders than cows, sheep, pigs, swine, and even dogs. They like to be super clean.
I love that for them.
They're so cute. Goats are evil, but they're also adorable.
I know this is the wrong fandom, but I guess that means Grover is one of the most hygienic people at that camp.
That man eats trash.
recyclables, but he takes not a lot trash. Of
that's true. That's true. Yeah, he does. He grooms his goat fur meticulously. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of conditioner going on. Do you think he uses mane and tail?
Yes.
Is that what you use for goats? Because if so, then yes.
Well, that's what you use for animals.
For horses.
I know it was specifically for horses. I didn't know if it worked for goats, too.
I use it on my hair, so I feel like it counts.
Fair enough.
A new meaning of horse girl. Our intro and outro music is Mos Eisley Cantina by Speedkicks. Angela and I edit, our artwork is by me, and Sugar is our writer and researcher. You can find us on Instagram and Tumblr at UnleashTheGoats. Thanks for listening.